And I think it's going to be over quickly. I think Daniel Oliver is right. We're going to go from, like, let's say 3,000, 3,500, wherever we're going to be in a few months. We're going to go from there to maybe, like, for a week or two, we'll go down to maybe 2,000 in a panic, and then all the way up to like 9, 10,000 or more. I think that's what's going to happen. Hey guys, welcome to the Bitter Endgame Draft. It's been a while. Phil is back. I think he was on a hiking trip where he did not have time to talk, and he was hiking with his family, which is encouraged. You should do that and get off the phones and get off the computers and be in three-dimensional space. So, Phil, I hope you enjoyed your hike. And
I did.
what is going on your end of the world? We were just discussing before I started recording that it feels like everything is falling apart at a faster and faster pace, and like violence could break out anytime, everywhere simultaneously. We want to be ready for that, not with, a whole bunch of weapons, but with tools for exchange for people who won't be able to make exchanges if that happens.
So after our camping trip, we drove back. We swung by a Cracker Barrel on the way home, and I don't eat out very much
Wait,
after.
what's a Cracker Barrel? I don't know what that is.
Know what a Cracker Barrel is?
I've heard the name, but I don't know what it is.
It's like Applebee's, but its theme is like American in like the 40s and 50s. So it's all like, it's like the ads from the, like the walls are adorned with ads from Nabisco from like the 40s and 50s and stuff like that.
Have pretty curls, but I like Oreo. Curls are nice, but boy, what icing comes with Oreo?
And cigarette, like Lucky Strike cigarettes, that
Like
kind of stuff.
Johnny Rockets?
Yeah, it's kind of like that, but it's more homey. It's not like a diner. It's more going for like a country store. It's the motif. It's very schlocky. Like it is very, very schlocky. But they do serve, at least a pastiche of American home, like home style cooking from the good old days of America. But
Okay.
it is fast. I mean, it's fascinating that you can tell that was a prosperous time and that the restaurant is trying to capture the motif of the prosperity and that like something's missing because it's all like plastic. Like it's the decorations on the wall, they'll be like old gas cans and stuff like that. And you're like, that was a, you have the feeling like, oh, that was a time when America was very sure of itself and we are no longer. But the reason I brought this up was I covered this on my I don't eat out much. Before COVID, we ate quite a bit, but during COVID, we just stayed home because it was a pain in the ass to go out. And we also discovered we saved a ton of money, and B, we really liked it. Like we enjoyed cooking and spending time with each other at home and stuff. So we just really stopped going out. But coming back from there, we actually stopped by a Cracker Barrel, and I hadn't been in a restaurant in a very long time. And the bill was substantially higher than I remember. And I looked, I was going through it and it was like $4 for an iced tea. It was like $4 for an iced tea. And this is, we
Right.
discuss inflation every single day. And still I was caught off guard. Just this deep, I had this deep visceral reaction to iced tea being $4 when I know it should be $1.50 to $2 max, right? So
Yeah.
it's this, even with my thorough understanding of what's happening, you still get caught off guard when reality smacks you in the face.
Yeah, it happens to me too, because I've been preparing my family for this, particularly my wife who does the shopping for years. I'm like, look, food prices are going to go up here, especially here because there's a war, and Turkey is embargoing us and not trading with us anymore, and there's going to be more countries that cut us off. That happens, and there's really nothing we can do about it. But grocery prices are going to go up, and even though I'm rooting for it because I know that we have to get through this part in order to get to the end, it still hurts. And I'm still cutting back on other things that I didn't cut back on a year or two ago. Like, I used to buy a beer a week for Shabbat. I bought, a nice beer for Shabbat dinner, but now I'm not doing that. And that's probably better for me, but I still miss it. And
Yeah.
It's the inflation hurts, even if you're rooting for it, even if you want it in your intellect, you don't want it in your emotions.
Well, why don't you buy 100 beers now and then drink one a week so that would stop the you'll have locked in the
I
fridge.
could theoretically do that, but I know myself, and having 100 beers in my house is not a good idea for me.
Okay. You keep it limited. Okay.
Yeah.
Guys, hurry up!
How long do we
So
think
you
silver will stay remonetized? In parentheses, you have, I think it actually might be quite a while, the more I think about it. What are you thinking about? Why are you thinking about it that way? And why is it being more and more in your head? I haven't really worked out how long it's going to be, but I do know that the longer that we're going to be using silver coins, the worse the initial imp that means the worse the initial impact of the end game is going to be.
So I've been thinking about this because you had a video, you put out several videos. You said it might be as fast as a day, where just or a few days where
No, I think it'll be
silver.
longer than a few days. I'm just hoping, but it's going to be
Yeah.
longer than a few days.
So I said, well, and I started thinking, well, how long? So let's think about it. So let's steel man the Fed here in the Treasury. So they've got a full 8,300 tons of gold. It's all there. It's all accounted for. And there's no liens on it, or they're just going to give the finger to anyone who calls in the liens and say, sorry, no, we didn't actually mean you could have the gold when we loaned it out to you. We just meant you could say you had it. So let's say they default on that, they keep it in there, and they're going to reestablish the currency when the current dollar dies, and we'll call the new currency the new dollar, right? So the first problem is the gold is in huge bar forms. Well, sorry, let me run this a second. The derivatives, let's the new dollar is going to be 100% backed by gold. Let's say it's $100 equals 1 ounce of gold, just for simplicity, right? And they start issuing these new dollars. What are people going to do the second they get their hands on new dollars after a global hyperinflation where all paper currencies in the world at the same time collapsed?
Okay,
They're
so
going to exchange gold.
I'm gonna try to simplify this and
Okay.
continue where you left off. And
Okay.
I'm just simplifying the reasoning, the logical changes made. So if we follow Daniel Oliver's logic, right, that in 1980 at $650, the dollar was on a gold standard by the market, because the market value of the gold that you steel man that was on the Fed's balance sheet equaled 100% of the Fed's other liabilities. That was an overshot. That was an overshoot even back then, because the remaining debt on the Fed's balance sheet still had value because it was still possible to pay those high interest rates. And even then, even in a situation where it was possible to service that debt, the market still insisted for a few days on 100% gold backing. So this time, if it's going to be worse and all of the bonds on the Fed's balance sheet really go to market value of zero, that means that the remaining gold on its balance sheet will have to balance out the rest of its liabilities, which are the paper dollars on its that are on the other side of the assets, by 100%, which means that the other assets are worthless, because otherwise gold wouldn't have to compensate 100% for them, right?
Yes.
And so what would happen is not even that you wouldn't they wouldn't even have to issue new dollars. There'd just be dollars, and then the m most of the debt would be worthless, and gold would take its place as backing the remaining dollars. But what you would have is a serious global banking crisis, where
Yeah.
none of the banks in the world would be able to work with their current balance sheets, and they'd all have to reset
I was going to get into
based on
that
this
point.
new dollar. And then the question is, how do all the countries reorganize their financial affairs without mass riots?
So the only reason I said they're going to make a new dollar is because there's going to be too many zeros. Like, but going to gold now, you're talking what I think we said $50,000 an ounce or something.
Something like that. That
It's
would be
going to be.
around 100%. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's going to be probably too many zeros. Maybe they want to keep it that way. I don't know. That's irrelevant. The number of zeros is irrelevant. Whether they make a new dollar or use the existing dollar and just peg it back to gold. What are people going to do? They're gonna say, I want the gold. Like, I don't trust this paper. I'm never going to trust it again for the rest of my life. Now, maybe they will change their mind later, but in the initial aftermath, they're gonna say, I don't want paper ever again in my life. I want the gold. There's immediate problems. First off, all the gold is in giant bars at Fort Knox. They're going to have to melt it down and then redistribute it. Now, how are they going to redistribute it? All the banks, like you just said, are out of business. Wells Fargo's gone, Bank of America's gone. They're all gone because they didn't have any money in them. And a bank is a place where you store your money. Now the buildings are still there. New banks can show up, But this initial blast is going to be, there's no banks to go to exchange your dollars in, and get the gold. And the banks that will be there won't have the gold. So there's this liquidity problem immediately, where just all the gold was originally widely distributed, and then the geniuses in the 30s decided, let's all get all and put it in one single building in giant bars and make it as illiquid as we possibly can. So there's going to be a re-liquefying problem, and I don't think they can do what they did in the 30s, where they just said, oh, just use the notes, we'll keep the bars here, and they represent the notes, but you know, you can't physically change it. I don't think the market's going to buy that. I really don't. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe
Well,
I'm wrong, but I don't think.
I think you're right about that, but they wouldn't be exchanging gold with the Fed. They'd be exchanging gold with whoever has any at the 100 at around the 100% backing market rate. And
Well,
then
they'd want to
you
redeem the
would
notes.
see what?
They'd want to redeem the notes for the gold.
Yeah. They'd have to redeem, they'd have to change, you'd have to go to a coin shop or Monetary Metals or Miles Franklin or whatever, and then get some gold and use that. But then the exchange rate would, assuming that bonds have all gone to zero or something close to it, and they're effectively worthless and nobody wants them, then demonstrably you have people going to coin shops and buying gold because they don't want the paper. But eventually the exchange rate would balance out at somewhere around 50,000, assuming bonds are worthless. And then I think maybe the paper, this is the best case scenario. I could be wrong. I'm just trying to figure out possibilities here. Maybe the paper would still be functional at $50,000 an ounce, and then somebody would lop off three zeros or something.
It would have to be redeemable at some point in the chain. Like at some point, you have to be able to show up at some door, whether it's the Federal Reserve door itself or the banks, and say, here's $50,000, give me an ounce of gold. Somebody has to take that note. That's the only thing that gives it any value to, you know, if you can't exchange it anywhere, then Monetary Metals isn't going to take, they'll say, I'll just keep the gold. I'm not going to take your paper in exchange for gold. So I think it's going to have to be redeemable on some level. Now, you know, maybe you can't show up with $50 and demand a grain of gold. Maybe you have to show up with, enough to get, a sizable chunk out of a bank. But I don't know. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. The market will decide that one. But anyway, so during this liquidity crunch, so all the banks are gone, not functioning well at a bare minimum, unable to service their clients very well. People are going to need things, something to trade with, and that is where silver and copper come in as the money of daily life. And so that's when silver remonetizes and people start trading in that until the banks get their shit together.
Okay, so you're saying how long do you think it would take for the banks to get their shit together?
That's a good question.
Yeah. You said the more you think about it, the longer you think it's going to take. Why? What's your thought process?
Well, that's why. I mean, the like I just explained, the decentralization process of the gold, because people are going to say, I want my gold redeemed. I want to be able to redeem the paper before I trusted it again, right? So once they redeem and they have the gold in their house, and they're like, well, it's in my house now and it's dangerous, so I think I want to put it back in a bank. So they take it back to the bank and get another note, right? That process is going to take time to build the trust. The bank has to rebuild and say, no, we're not the Ponzi scheme we were. Now we are a firm, sound institution. Look, we have armed guards protecting your real money, which is gold, in the bank. Come deposit, we'll give you the notes, all that thing. They're gonna have to win the trust of the public back. So I'm thinking, I mean, I'm pulling a number out of my hat here, but I'm thinking, 5 years, maybe 10 years.
5, 10 years. Okay. Well, if we're talking about
And of course, it's
the
not,
collapse of the global banking system, we're talking about the end of global wars, or at least the breaking up of wars from huge conflicts to little petty cross-border skirmishes everywhere, which could be just as scary, depending on how you look at it. But I mean, personally, I'd rather have little border skirmishes between all these little countries than threat of nuclear war between Russia and NATO. It just seemed, but then you could argue like who's gonna have the nuclear weapons? This is why I don't really think about nuclear weapons. I just leave that in God's hands because really there's nothing else I can do or think about it. Of the things that I can't control, the least thing I can control is how Russia and NATO handle their nuclear arsenals. They're not really, talking to me about it. So
I mean, I will say this, having people that are on death's doorstep with nothing left to lose, with their finger on the nuclear button is kind of scary. Because they know as soon as they're out of power, like their family's gonna be prosecuted and they have no more access to power. Like, it is a little scary.
5 years. I don't think it's going to take 5 years. I think it's going to take about a year. Because if I imagine how I would be motivated with the amount of silver I have, and I don't have a crazy amount of silver. I have like enough for a year's worth of expenses at, at let's say $25, $30 an ounce in today's dollar terms, right? Not a huge amount. But more than most people apparently. So what I would do if I suddenly saw a 15-to-1 ratio, which would signal the end game. I don't think there's anything any recovering from a 15-to-1 ratio this time. Then I would spend it all as fast as I could,
Yeah,
because
there's no reason to hoard the silver. Absolutely. I mean, once it hits 15 to 1, it's not going to go
yeah, but
any.
it
It's not
wouldn't be
going
just me. It would be like people taking their kiddish cups and
to.
their candlesticks and their silverware and just buying anything they can get with it, and it would just
Yes.
blast out, which is what but because we're so trained to have not a 15-to-1 ratio, and for it to last for such a short period of time, that it would encourage this blast of silver out into the econosphere, and then the ratio would go back up to maybe like 30, 40 to 1 pretty quickly. I mean,
I don't know
that's
because
how I'm seeing it. Maybe I could be totally wrong about that. I don't know.
I
But
think, I mean, I think
I
I
would
see
personally be I would I'm saying I'd personally be motivated to jettison almost my entire silver hoard to get whatever
Yeah,
I could.
I totally agree with you there. There's no reason to keep it. You should, and it helps the more silver that's flowing, the less this is going to suck anyway. So you should definitely disgorge your silver. But the question is, how long will it take? Once you bought your mansions and your Porsche and all that stuff, how long before you can actually drive the Porsche down the street without experiencing gunfire? There
I don't think it's going to
go.
take 5 years, and I guess I could base this loosely on some religious texts, like when the Mashiach comes, it's going to lead to like about a year of war and then a calming down, and that could there's sources in the Talmud about this, about it takes about a year for things to calm down, and we already see. We were discussing like war is about to break out everywhere between Russia and NATO, possibly, and we're looking at a possible civil war developing in the United States if the blue team cheats or the blue team accuses the red team of cheating or whatever. They're both accusations are going to fly every way, and depending on what states are going to line up and what they think they can accomplish, you could have some maybe secession. I don't know, and some violence. Violence is breaking out here all the time, and we're always threatening to invade Lebanon. It could happen tomorrow. But yeah, there's a huge war, world war, global war that's just simmering, and it's gonna blow up. And hopefully that will coincide with also the monetary crisis, and how we can get all this stuff done at the same time, because everything's linked anyway. And I hopefully it won't take more than a year to calm down.
From your lips to God's ears, I guess. I would prefer everything to go back. Even if we get 5 years of silver at 15 to 1, and people like us do very, very well in that scenario, I would much prefer we get back to functioning civilization. Because then you're
Yeah.
talking, it's hard to get the electricity bill. It's hard to keep electricity running on the silver standard, or with silver moving, I should say. With having to pay in physical coinage, because the utility man has to come physically to your door, take the silver out of your hand, put it into his coffers, and then drive away. That's it. They did do it. That's how they did it in the past,
Yeah.
but it's not
So
as efficient.
that, but also the entire structure of the global economy is going to have to change drastically. I mean, these
And
centralized,
quickly.
these extremely concentrated and centralized food production pieces of capital, and the way that we produce massive amounts of food, and what every I can only think of food, but like everything is centralized, or construction material. anything. It's all extremely centralized. But is it centralized physically, or is it just centralized through ownership, or is it this, or is it both, or is that the same thing? I don't really understand that much about the actual structure of the centralization to comment that much on it.
Well, at least for farming, I mean, you talk about these giant combines instead of a small farmer with his tractor, right? So, and you need the land to rep you need the land to make the combine worth it, and you need the combine to make, to actually get all that land harvested. So if we break up into, small, if the farm parcels break up into small yeoman farmers again, then they all have to get much smaller combines and farm their local land. And yeah, then you're talking, yeah, you are talking about not enough, not certainly lean times compared to what we've seen before. But I mean, people lived in the Soviet Union for 80 years. They didn't, they didn't thrive, but you survive. You make it work. If they can get through that, then we can get through this.
So then why the Dark Ages? Why did they last 1,000 years?
That's a good question. That's a very good question. It seems like when something blows apart, maybe it takes a while to congeal. I think in our advanced state, I think we can congeal much faster. I don't think it's going to be 1,000 years, if that makes sense. Now, look, if we blow ourselves back to the 1700s, then yeah, then but we're also going to have a 1700s population, and that's going to be grim. So let's not dwell on that too much. But I think, look, I mean, the satellites are still up there. The buildings are all
They're
still
gonna
there.
stop. Their orbits are gonna break down. There's gonna be
All
a
the
whole
orbits are
shower
going
of space
to
junk hitting everybody. God.
Yeah. I mean, we still have, the books are all written. We understand how fit, I mean, I guess part of the problem is the fall of Rome was like, the libraries were burned, and that's where the knowledge was.
Well, the priests, I think the Catholic priests saved a lot.
Yeah. They did. So I mean, you can keep things. I think we can keep the knowledge base and the tech base. I don't think we're going back into a dark. I mean, we're compared to the hedonistic life we're living right now, where like you can have avocado toast on demand. Yeah, I think that's probably going away. I think you're going to have wherever you are much more local food, and that may not include avocados. So yeah, that the joy of that is probably going away, at least for quite some time. But are you going to have no food? I don't think so. So I hope
No,
not anyway.
I think the desperation will quickly break up the capital that needs to be broken up, and the explosion of silver into the monetary system will provide the people who can make the capital make smaller pieces, and it'll take some time, but yeah, it's not going to take 1,000 years, and I don't think it's going to take five. I'm betting on a year, maybe two.
You relentless optimist, you. So let
Okay.
me ask you this. I think silver's going to stay money or stay monetized for quite some time after that as well, even at 30 or 40 to one rather than, 15 to one. Because I think there will still be, it'll be like America in the 1940s, right? There were gold certificates, but there people still used the coinage of silver to break down the gold.
Well, after this, the gold supply and the silver supply are going to be radically decentralized.
Yeah.
And what I'm hoping to see is competing gold and silver money derivatives and private money derivatives. And then you have just competition between the derivatives. And then when you have competition, the most honest derivative wins. That's just how it works in every industry, right? Unless the government comes in and subsidizes its buddies, and then the whole thing starts over again.
As it often does. All right,
Yeah.
we want to move on to yield curves, right?
Right. So let's go over the yield curves. You're still being peppered with questions that implying that everyone gets it. And I especially liked your analogy of the yield curve, that it doesn't make any economic sense to loan out money for a longer period for less interest because we're all mortal and we're all going to die. But what the central bank can do is it can presumably or make it look like it's breaking economic law, just like when you throw a ball up in the air, it looks like there's no gravity, but then eventually gravity takes over. So that really
Yes.
helped me. That helped me understand it. So, yeah, the yield curve right now is normalizing. I'll share a graphic of this, the 10-year minus 2-year. It's all just arbitrary, whatever spread you pick. If it's below zero, then long-term rates are shorter than short-term, or long-term rates are lower than short-term rates. And if it's above zero, then long-term rates are higher than short-term rates. So really, in a stable economy, it should like just go a weekly up and down with a very low amplitude at whatever the rate of profit is, let's say 2% or whatever it should be, and not going radically up and down like this, and especially never below zero. So this is just evidence that natural forces are fighting the central bank, and the central bank is fighting natural forces. That's what it shows. What's your commentary on this chart over here?
So the well, I noticed that the news and then financial YouTube was all they were all a buzz about the yield curve uninverting, and they're saying this is a 100% sign of a recession. And the yeoman's takeaway, like if you were not fully understanding what was happening, the takeaway would be, well, don't let the yield curve uninvert. You're gonna constantly keep the yield curve inverted, otherwise we're gonna have a
Yeah,
recession.
that's not good.
And my point, the point I made that the channel was that that's like we the inversion of the curve itself is a defiance of nature, and it cannot be avoided. And the if you did nothing, if the Fed was like, no, we're going to keep it inverted, what's going to happen is you're going to get a massive sell-off on the long-term bonds when there's liquidity. So if you think of it, when people are holding long-term debt, and then the short-term debt ends up higher, they hold on to their long-term debt because they think, oh, this is just a temporary blip, it's going to go back down. But the longer they hold the line, the longer the Fed holds the line here, and the short-term debts gets more and more
The more money
expensive,
they're losing.
the more money they're losing. Exactly right. And eventually there's a liquidity crunch, and then they panic and they say, fine, just sell everything. And that's when the long-term bonds yields also skyrocket because the long-term bonds are being tossed as well. Now, usually before then, the Fed starts cutting rates. That's what they call the bear steepener. Everyone's talking about the bull and the bear steepener. The bear steepener is a panic sell-off to uninvert the yield curve because nature's being defied, and nature will not be defied forever. The bull steepener is when the Fed says, you know what, never mind, we're going to slam rates back down, and they uninvert on this side, and that's when the part that's oh have another party. That's what's called bull steepener, because let's have another party. And it's usually some combination of the two that causes the yield curve to re-uninvert, but that is a sure sign of an imminent Keynesian recession. The yield curve uninverting does not cause the recession. It's an in, the what's happening is the Fed is in full panic mode. That's why they slam the interest rates back down to zero, because there's a recession coming, slamming into them. So the uninversion is not causal to the recession. It's just an indicator. It's a correlated indicator of a recession. Continue.
So wait, on that topic, how does the Fed uninvert the yield curve by pushing short-term rates down?
Now, yes, exactly right. Yes, by going
Right.
back. The
Okay.
only one they have direct control over is the federal funds rate. Now they
Okay.
can, I think they can buy treasuries and stuff if they want to, but they try to avoid that because that is extremely inflationary.
It is extremely inflationary, and here's the proof of it. This is the Fed's balance sheet, right? But this is just the Treasuries on its balance sheet, right? So we see here from 2002 to 2008 or 2007, it's going up like in that same relentless, inexorable way, just very slowly higher and higher as they accumulate more and more Treasuries because the debt needs to always rise, and the money supply needs to rise with the debt because debt and money are two sides of the same fiat paper. And then look what happened in 2008, right? So the amount of treasuries actually went significantly down. This looks like QT, doesn't it? But it's not.
Yes.
QE was what was happening over here in March 2008, right? We're all familiar with the huge spike up in balance sheet around this time. But here is specifically when long-term treasuries were going down on its balance sheet because they were trying to balance it out. They thought they were going to buy this commercial paper, huge amounts of commercial paper, all this other stuff that they need to make li more liquid, but they did it by selling off treasuries at that time in order to make their balance sheet look a little bit less crazy.
So they were buying the mortgages and selling US treasuries, huh?
Yeah, that's what they were doing. They were trying to balance it out somewhat. They were being somewhat conservative and a little bit rational there, right?
Looks like they gave up. Nine,
Right? So
2009.
here's QE2 maybe, and then QE3, and then I don't know what this
Operation
is.
Twist.
What
That
this
one's probably
operation.
Twist.
Oh, this is twist or this is three. I don't know. There's twist and
Yeah.
there's three. Like one,
Was
two,
there some
three twist.
QE? We're gonna twist and twist and twist it till we tear the house down. What's the difference between QE and Operation Twist? I mean, did anything functionally differ between Operation Twist and QE2?
Yeah, Operation Twist, that I think they were selling short term and buying long term with the proceeds, so they were
Okay.
twisting.
They were twisting,
Yeah. I think Peter Schiff called it Operation Screw, but that was his line. All right.
That's about right. So anyway, when the Fed starts buying treasuries en masse, that's how the Mississippi bubble blew. In the John Law's Mississippi bubble in, I think it was pre-revolutionary France. I'm pretty sure it was
Yeah,
like during the
1720,
yes.
1720, I think.
This is the exact same scam as the Mississippi bubble. So if you read the Mississippi bubble, if you read about it, you will understand what happened. This is just on a much bigger scale, but it's the exact same scam. You can't the way a scam works is that you get other suckers to buy into your scam. If you have to buy the paper yourself, like if you have to buy the notes of the scam yourself, then the scam falls apart because you're the scam artist. You need other people to buy it. You can't buy your own paper.
Right, but the Fed does buy its own paper and it seems to elongate the scam every time it does it. But every time it elongates it, it's a shorter elongation than the time before.
It's illusory. It's illusory. So what they temporarily do is cause a boost of confidence, but each time they do it, it's less effective than the time they do it before, and eventually it all just goes to nothing.
Yeah, that's why my thesis is that the next time they do this, the next time they have to buy long-term treasuries because there's a huge clog somewhere, it's going to be the last time. That's going to be it. It's going to be over. And I think it's going to be over quickly. I think Daniel Oliver's right. We're going to go from, like, let's say 3,000, 3,500, wherever we're going to be in a few months. We're going to go from there to maybe, like, for a week or two, we'll go down to maybe 2,000 in a panic, and then all the way up to like 9, 10,000 or more. I think that's what's going to happen. So I don't, yeah, I'm making myself nervous even talking about
All right, let's get into your religious books. They provide you a great deal of comfort, and you know that talking to
Cool.
you makes me feel better as well. So
Well, that's good. Your next topic here is charity during and in the aftermath of the end game. I'm curious what your religious texts say. I'm also wondering how useful charity is in general. Does it just create a class of moochers and patrons, or does it lead to a more prosperous society? So first of all, we are strongly discouraged. Jews are strongly just discouraged from making a living bumming and snoring money. It's not ideal. You don't want to do it. It is embarrassing, and people should be embarrassed about it. As a living, it should not happen. We're commanded to work 6 days a week and rest on the seventh. If we're not working 6 days a week, that's a problem. So it's not ideal. And in terms of giving charity, there is a limit. We're not supposed to make money and then give it all the way to charity and say, "Well, God, that's a good deed, so you take care of me, and I'm just going to give away all of my belongings and all of my money." That's crazy. And we're not allowed to do that. The maximum that we are allowed to give to charity, no matter how much money we have, is 20%. Now, there are ways to get around it. If you're like a multi-billionaire and you want to set up a trust that helps education or hospitals or whatever, there's ways around it if you want to set up vehicles. But in general, like there weren't like billionaires back, 1500, 2000 years
Yeah,
ago.
that's also a function of the world
Yeah.
we're in. It's
There were
not,
rich people, and there were some very rich people, but the maximum we're supposed to give is 20%. And where do we get that from? One of the sources is that before the enslavement in Egypt, Joseph, after he took over the country, repeating pattern, Jews taking over countries and then getting enslaved. It's happening now. We're being accused of this. We're being accused of taking over the world, and soon we're going to be enslaved by different countries where, if we're not back home. And that's a warning, I'm telling you now. So he instituted a 20% tax. It's called a Chomesh, or 1/5. And he basically monopolized the entire silver supply. It belonged to Pharaoh, and then Pharaoh owned the entire country, and everyone was enslaved. And everyone had to give everyone he gave everyone a plot of land to grow food, and then said a fifth of it is mine, so 20%. So if you're paying 20% to your king, to your government, you're a slave. If you're paying more than that, oh boy, which we all are. So we're not allowed to give more than 20% in charity, and we have to give at least 10, no more than 20. And so that limits it. Like there is a limit to how much charity can do. So we don't want to make a class of people who bum around.
That makes sense. And then the social, in the old days of private charity, before before the government was just handing out welfare to everybody, you had to, you kind of had to do the shame ritual, right? The guy had to go, in front of his church or whatever and say, "Hey, I lost my job. I broke my leg and lost my job at the Boilermakers." And then can you, pass my hat around? I've been a loyal member of this church for many years and I've helped out in the church. Can everyone help me out and pass the hat around? They raise some charity for him, right? That actually happened to my paternal great grandfather on my grandmother's father. He worked in the rail yard, broke his leg, went on charity for a while. And this was in the Great Depression. And they lived on very, very little. So, but once the government comes in, and part of this is the government needs to increase the debt. So what better way to increase the debt than to borrow from the taxpayers and dole it out to moochers? And they say, don't have any shame in this. Just, you do whatever you need to do to take care of yourself. And here's a bunch of free money. And there are a bunch of economists who said, oh, let's make a UBI because that will maximize utility rather than giving people food stamps. We'll just give them cash and then they can do whatever they want with that. That'll maximize utility, right? But they're not thinking like economists have a tendency to get very autistic and not think about like the human element of creating. Oh, now we're just got a bunch of moochers sitting around playing Switch all day instead of going to do hard day's work.
I wouldn't even call them economists. They're just social engineers, and they're trying to create societies based on econometric gobbledygook equations. It's a different form of playing God. I mean, you're not supposed to engineer societies. We have a law. We have a natural law. We have, you could argue we have God's law. Follow that.
Sure.
That's it.
So when the people who didn't listen to you come knocking at your door in the end game, begging you for silver, do you have a percent in mind of how much you're going to dole out, like in terms of charity?
Maximum probably 20.
20%. Okay. So you have like 20% set
If
aside.
I do any more than that, if I do any more than that, it's bad for them.
That's true.
So I mean, I could hire people. I mean, it's not like people are going to lose their skills. Whatever skills they have, I can pay them. I can gather capital. I'd be willing to do that. But
Yeah.
I'm not going to give more than 20% away. I shouldn't.
Yeah.
Nobody should.
Yeah. So don't feel it's more of the view. I mean, I'm thinking also if this is advice for the viewers, like, if you can employ, it's actually better if you can employ people, if you can say, hey, mow my lawn or something, because then they don't feel like total losers and bums either. Like they feel like they did, they painted your house or they stood behind you with a palm frond and fanned you for a while.
People are going to be losing, they're going to have lost confidence in themselves and their entire paths in life, and it'll be up to us to try to regain, help them regain some of that confidence so that they can be part of whatever new division of labor exists. And the best way to do that is to hire them, not give them charity.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And if there, you know, if there's ch now, let me ask you this: Would you consider taking care of your parents' charity, or is that just like let's say your parents lose everything?
No, that's under a completely different mitzvah. That's honoring your father, your mother and father.
Okay. So
Whatever you give
that
them,
answers your
whatever you
question.
give them is not charity, it's your obligation.
Yeah. I'm not going to tell my parents tough luck. Thanks for taking care of me and sending me to George Mason. But yeah, good luck, guys.
So
Absolutely.
yeah,
Okay.
so
So yeah.
don't give more than 20%, and don't feel guilty if you give only 10. 10 is your 10 is your obligation, and 20 is the max. That's all. Don't
Okay.
take it any farther than that.
All right, finally, we had. So I have been, many people and the viewers have probably been on the internet before. And when you've been on the internet, you will run into people who don't care for the Jews very much. And they will, they cite the Talmud. They take passages out of the Talmud and, or they make up passages that they
It's
cite out of
mostly made up. It's like
the
I've looked through these sheets. It's about 80-90% totally fabricated completely, and about 10 to 20% which have a basis in truth and to totally taken out of context. And that's pretty much the split. It's like an 80-20 split.
So there's one, before we get into the financial one, there's one that's like really prominent, and it's like sex among Gentiles is like sex among cattle, some rabbi said somewhere. And upon, you know, the initial reading of that is like, well, that's pretty derogatory to other people. But if you read what the is, and I think you explain it to me, what they are talking about is the virginity of Jewish girls and how important that is for their for your religious needs. You know, marrying a high priest or something. Is there any other reason to, I mean, just also just to stay pure, but.
Well, I think we had the discussion, and I think it cited page 76B of Sanhedrin or something. And then I looked through that daf, and I didn't see anything related to, sex with animals compared to sex with Gentiles. I've never heard of any source like that. And
Okay, so this is a made up one. All right, never mind.
no,
I'm
I said theoretically, like if you would have a discussion in the Talmud about, let's say, the rape of children, right? And then the conclusion being that raping a girl below the age of three, theoretically, she's still a virgin after that rape because her hymen grows back. It's a legal category. It's not, so you could read that one way. Oh, well, Jews encourage the rape of 2-year-old girls. Or you can just, it's, we're defining what virginity is through the most extreme possible cases, so that we can create a legal framework for things that we have to deal with when dealing with
Yeah.
sexual issues,
Well,
right?
what
So
that law is actually saying is, I think you explained to me, was that the girl should not be punished as somebody who has lost her virginity because she was molested as a child, as a very small child. Right. So this is actually, you know, victim protection laws. But, you know, it's not reading that it's open season on everyone's children. And the even the one with the sex among the Gentiles, assuming it's real, is sex among the Gentiles the same as sex among cattle or something like that. The reason they are saying that is that they're saying maybe it's an if it is real, we'll have to figure out if it's real or not. But if it is real, maybe it's indelicately worded. But what they're saying is that our Jewish laws are talking about Jews. We don't care about the virginal status of Gentile women because they're not our women. So that's for you. That's for you people to decide if you care about that or not. That's not our business. That's sort of what. That's the way I interpreted what they were. What the what. I think what you said they were saying. So anyway, let's go to the market here. So there are tracts in there about how Jews and Gentiles deal with each other, and there are a bunch of laws that the Jews must treat each other in ways that they do not have to treat Gentiles. And the initial reading of that is that, you know, it's like the happy merchant meme. We're like, yes, do what you will with the goyim. But if you read it another way, the way I read it, the way I understand it, the rabbis are saying we have social enforcement mechanisms within our community. So if you go to sell your car that your car was in a bomb blast, right? And you put some putty on over the holes and then you repaint it and you go sell your cars as new or good
Yeah,
as new.
he's not speaking theoretically. He's literally, my car was bombed. Yeah.
Yes, your
Putty
car has a
on.
bunch of shrapnel in it, so you putty it over and then you paint it, you know, you paint over the holes and then you go sell it as new, and then the guy buys it and a little bit, you know, a week later the LPG tank blows up and he can go to under this, you know, Talmudic law, he can go to the rabbis and say he sold me a car with shrapnel holes in it and he didn't tell me. And they can make you whole. They can make him whole. They can say, Rafi, you shouldn't have done that. You have to recompensate him for the lemon you sold him. What they're saying is that we have no enforcement mechanism among Gentiles. We cannot go to a Gentile, especially like this is written like the Roman times, right?
This was written a few, like, it's that's a hard question.
Or the
Just because it
Dark
was written
Ages.
in a certain time doesn't mean that the law existed way, way before that. It
Well, my
was,
point is they can't go to Caesar and be like, "Hey, Caesar,
yeah.
Vittorio over here sold Shmuel a rabid donkey. You need a refund." Caesar can say, "No, we don't care about you." Right? So what they're saying is we have no enforcement mechanisms. We have no market enforcement mechanisms for fair trade on the outside of our community. So you are on your own. Now that goes both ways. It just means we're not getting involved. So if you sell your car to a Gentile, that's none of our business. And the Gentile needs to do a full examination of the car. And if he buys it, then he buys it. And good luck to him.
Look, so I'll simplify this, and then I'll just show you the sources in plain Hebrew and English. Look, there's three issues here. There's stealing. There's two kinds of stealing. There's robbery and theft. Robbery is out in the open. Theft is in private, right? And there's different laws regarding each of them. There's also returning lost objects, and being upfront in business, like completely upfront. So returning lost objects is Hashavas Aveda, and Jews have a special obligation to return lost objects to each other. That means you have a lost and found, you announce things. Whereas if you're in a Gentile city or a non-Jewish city, and there's like an object that you would have to announce in a Jewish neighborhood, you don't have to, you could just take it. It's yours. This is not taking into account the law of the land in that place, but in Jewish law, you do not have to return a lost object to a Gentile. There's no inyan of that, because the verse says la'achicha, to your brother, you return lost objects, which excludes goyim. The other thing is being upfront in business, or causing an error, right? Or if you see a Gentile do an error in a market exchange, you don't have to correct him. You don't have to go out of your way to correct him, but you can't make him make that mistake. You can't mislead him purposely. So I'll just read the sources here. This is a digested version,
Cliff
or
notes.
a digested version of the Talmud by the Rambam, by Maimonides, who basically systematically went through both Talmuds, the Jerusalem Talmud and the Babylonian Talmud. There's two of them, and he organized everything conceptually in 14 books. So this is basically the conclusions, the halakhic conclusions of the Talmud regarding theft and robbery from Gentiles and Jews. So this is Law 1, Chapter 1 of the laws of Gzela of robbery and lost items. So I'll just read the English here. I'll skip the Hebrew. It says, whoever robs an object worth a pruta, which is like 2.5 cents, from a or maybe 3 cents now because of inflation, right? It's a copper piece. From a colleague transgresses a negative commandment, as Leviticus 19:13 says, do not rob. Violation of this negative is not punished by lashes, because it can be corrected by the fulfillment of a positive commandment, which is returning the money, right? Returning what you stole. If you violate something that can be corrected theoretically, then you don't get whipped, right? Whipping is only for things that can't correct. If a person robs, he is obligated to return what he obtained by robbery. As it says in 5:23, he shall return the article he obtained by robbery. This is a positive commandment. Now in two, it says here, it is forbidden to rob even the slightest amount. That means even less than a pruta, even less than you would have to pay back. It's still forbidden to rob even a penny, even less than the minimum amount. Even you don't have to pay it back, but it's still forbidden to do that. It is forbidden even to rob or withhold money from a Gentile who worships idols. If one robs or withholds money from such a person, one must return it. Simple. Okay, that's the conclusion. You cannot rob Gentiles. Next,
Except in San Francisco under $900.
So this is about stealing. The other was about open theft. Lashes are not administered for the violation of this commandment. For this is also about theft. This is not open robbery. This is theft. It's different. The Torah requires the thief to compensate the party for whom he stole, whether he be a Jew or a Gentile, an adult or a minor. It doesn't matter who you steal from. You cannot do it. Okay, so that should settle that. And nobody disagrees with the Rambam here. The difference is in lost objects. So here it says in chapter one, chapter 11, halacha 3, it is permissible to keep an object lost by an idolater, because Deuteronomy 22:3 speaks of returning an object lost by your brother. Indeed, if one returns such an article or transgressions of prohibition, for one strengthens the power of the wicked peoples of the world. So returning a lost object to an idol worshiper is you're not supposed to do that, because then you're making him richer, and if you don't have to, then you shouldn't, right? But if, however, one returns it to sanctify God's name so that others will praise the Jewish people and know that they are trustworthy, this is praiseworthy. So basically, we're dealing with the situation here of if the goyim are nice and there's no problem with them, then you should return their lost objects, because then it will increase our name among the Gentiles. But if we're dealing with hostile people, there's no reason to go out of your way to return their objects when you don't have to do that, right? Okay, so the last thing I'm going to do here is this is a story that is actually pertinent today, because it talks about Arabs. Okay, this is Devarim Rabbah. This is not halachic, but it is what do you call that? Stories, exegesis on Deuteronomy. Okay, so this is going off on some verse. You don't have to get into what verse it is, but it's telling a story. There was an incident involving Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach. So this is around the time of the late Hashmonaic dynasty, the late Hasmonean dynasty. So Shimon ben Shetach was the head of the rabbinical court at the time when Alexander Janaeus, or Alexander Yanai, was king from the Hasmonean dynasty, and one of his attendants, one of Yanai's slaves, happened to be Herod the Great. Right before he was great, he was a slave to the Hasmonean. So this is around maybe 100 before the Common Era, right? So there was an incident involving Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach, who purchased a certain donkey from a certain Ishmaelite, from a Yishmaeli, meaning an Arab, right? Before they were Muslims, Islam didn't exist back then. So he was definitely an idolater. He wasn't like a monotheist. He was an idolater, straight up. His disciples went and found on the donkey a gem suspended from its neck. They said to him, "Rabbi, the blessing of the Lord, it will enrich, right? You do not have to give back a lost object to a goy, to a Yishmaelite. He can keep that gem. He can do it if he wants to." Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach said to them, "I purchased a donkey. I did not purchase a gem." He went and returned it to that Ishmaelite. That Ishmaelite called out in this regard, "Blessed is the Lord God of Shimon ben Shetach. That is, from the faithfulness of mortal men, you can know the faithfulness of the Holy One. Blessed be He was faithful to pay Israel war for the mitzvah they perform." So it is a good idea to return lost objects to non-Jews if it is going to increase the name of God in the world. Otherwise, if you're under attack, then you don't want to give them back their resources if you can avoid it. That's basically the difference here.
That makes sense. That makes sense. I mean, that the no society, if the Talmud really was written the way people say it's, you know, the people who don't like the Jews are saying it's written, the society would not function. It would be just the worst, most horrible society you could imagine. And it wouldn't function among themselves or either. It's just not possible. So I was suspicious. I was highly suspicious that the words, even the ones that are there, mean what they were saying they meant.
They don't.
All well, that's about an hour off. You can call it here if you want. Any final thoughts?
So I do think we're I think we're within
Striking
we
distance.
could see the end game by the end of this year, by December, maybe November. It could be longer than that, but I think we're in the months phase, and I've put together some calculations about how many weeks it might take. We're going to see two things. We're going to see some obvious Keynesian style recession indicators, like we saw in 2008. And we're also this time we're going to see a clog in the plumbing. And I don't know if they're going to come at the same time, or one after the other, or what's going to come first exactly, but we're going to see both of those things. And once we have both of those things, I think the end game is just ahead.
How long do you think Endgame is going to take?
So,
Weeks?
I know that's the same question as how long are we going to be using silver?
That's true.
I think from when from I would say maybe from when the plumbing panic starts to the death of the dollar, maybe 3, 4, 5 months, something like that, and then we'll be in the 15-to-1 universe for how long? Maybe a year, and then we can rebuild after that. But things are coming apart pretty fast, and I'm feeling it. War's about to break out here again. It keeps doing that, and hopefully we can all stay safe.
Well, on that note, I am on that note of staying safe. I just want to remind viewers, I am going once the peanut butter makes contact with the fan, I am going dark. So I'm going to private all my videos and shut down my Twitter and stuff because there's once the market is making clear that the direction to go in, there's really no need for my services.
Yeah.
So once I go dark, that's why, and you will know at that point that at least I think the end game has started. That will be my trigger. Now maybe it hasn't actually started, and I'm just Chicken Little, but that's when I will have thought that it has started.
Hopefully, I will be Treasury Secretary Treasury in Israel or something like that. Be in charge of the temple's hoard of silver. That would be my dream job. That would be nice.
That'd be amazing.
And Phil, you're invited to come in and give a sacrifice if you would like to do so. Anyone can come give any sacrifice they want once we start it up again. You can't go into the actual temple. That's only for priests. I can't even go there. But if you feel like bringing a lamb or a cow, you're all invited.
That'd be awesome. Thanks, Robbie.